The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Happy Friday. It's The Takeaway for September 23rd, 2016. Remember, if you like this program, you can check out more information about the topics we're talking about at thetakeaway.org. And if you like this podcast, subscribe, will you? It's on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and tell a friend as well. Also, leave us a comment if you can. It helps us out a lot. Thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Listening to history.
We got out of the chattel slavery, and I was better off for getting out, but Rosa don't think so. She says all we got freed for is to starve to death. She says her white folks were good to her. But don't you expect me to love my white folks?
I never did know nothing about my pa, but I looked on my mama like a savior. Her name was Hannah Clemon, and Dr. Andrews, my master, had always owned her.
This history, slave narratives of Jack and Rosa Maddox, were brought to life by an HBO documentary, the voices of actor Ossie Davis and Sarah Daly. And all Americans can take a step closer to that history of slavery and more, the broader history of African Americans, when the long-awaited National Museum of African American History and Culture opens in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. A century in the making. Its origins date back to 1915, when black Civil War veterans began raising funds to honor black troops. In a sense, it is not unlike the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which when it opened, I remember, in 1982, became a sacred place of national pilgrimage for those who experienced the war, those who did not, those who suffered a lost loved one, and those who felt the need to pay homage to those who did. When President Obama rings in the official opening tomorrow, it will be from a 500-pound bell from First Baptist Church in Williamsburg, Virginia, a church founded by slaves and free blacks back in 1776. The tolling of the bell and the opening of the museum dedicated to the African-American experience is a milestone in a history still unfolding today. Joining us are two people who visited the museum at a special reception last weekend. Gail Jessup White is a direct descendant to Thomas Jefferson, who has been sharing history for years as part of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello in Virginia. And Don Felder, cousin to the late trailblazing tennis player Althea Gibson, who paved the way for the Williams sisters. Felder brought one of Gibson's tennis rackets to the museum, where it is now on display. For both of them, this is a homecoming and a place for sharing history near to where so much was made during the Civil Rights Movement. Crowds on the National Mall then, more crowds will come tomorrow.
I was there last Saturday, and I was among 3,000 very happy guests who've waited so many years for this museum to open. I grew up in Washington, D.C., with the among the greatest museums in the world, and they were all free, which was a wonderful thing about growing up in Washington. And we've been waiting for this for 100 years, when the idea of this museum first percolated from black veterans of the Civil War in 1915. So Saturday is going to be a tremendous day, and last Saturday was a tremendous day. You were there, Don. We didn't see each other, but...
right. And I agree. It was exciting. It was sort of a relief that finally the history of our people is there for the world to see and have a better understanding of a people.
It also seems that this moment is something unique to Washington, D.C., in that it brings out a communal sense of relief from all races and all members of the community and all citizens who can finally share a history, even though it may have affected us all differently. I remember when the Vietnam Veterans Memorial opened, it seemed like everyone in town had a part of that. And Washington is the only city that's really capable of doing that sort of thing. Does it feel like that to you, Don?
It absolutely did. I mean, people were excited. I took Uber, and there were Africans who would drop me off and pick me up, and they wanted to know what it was like there, what was inside, and they saw people coming every day. Gail, you saw people there during the last Saturday's reception. Everyone was there.
And if I just may add to what Don has said, yes, this is a history of African Americans, but this is also American history. It belongs to all of us. I know that African Americans have a very special place for this museum, but this is also America's museum.
At a time when there are so many difficult conversations taking place about race and tension and fear, I think, among peoples, this place really does hold out the promise of allowing people to see with some clarity America's history rather than to live in their own bubbles. And this comes at the perfect time, wouldn't you say, Don?
You're absolutely right, John. I think that best describes it. Clarity.
You're a part of the history in that you actually donated an artifact that can be seen, I believe, in the museum.
Yes, I donated a number of Althea's personal possessions. And, of course, I saw only the tennis racket when I was there. But when I walked through the door, my first thought was, they now have a home. They have a place where, you know, they're among great people, their voices are heard, their story is now told, and I think they'd be very proud just to know that they're receiving the recognition that they are today.
Althea Gibson's tennis rackets. I imagine a lot of people packed up some boxes and brought it down to the museum. Gail, I suspect, quite literally, you're a part of the history as well.
I feel honored that you would say that I'm part of the history. Certainly, the enslaved community of Monticello is part of that history. There's an exhibit there of Thomas Jefferson, and behind him, it's in bronze, and behind him are more than 600 bricks with the names of every enslaved person there, and some of my relatives' names are on those bricks. Some of those names, if I may say, Lucy, Sally, Henry, Anderson. It brought tears to my eyes to see my ancestors and my relatives recognized, to know that their lives will be remembered in their names. That's very significant. And it's emblematic of the work that we're doing at Monticello and of work that's going on at other historic sites. So it was a very memorable evening.
You got to go see it. It tells a story. It tells the story of a people. From start to until today, I mean, from the voyages and every nationality that took part in this trade is there, is visible. You know who. I spent a lot of time in Ghana. And, you know, most people go to Ghana and they go to two slave forts, Elmina and Cape Coast. There are others that were operated by the Swedes, by the Danes. So this tells the story.
Gail, what's an example of an arresting, perhaps even alarming image and artifact that you would see in the museum, and then something that would express maybe even hope or a sense of solidarity, like we understood back in the 60s, that sometimes seems hard to remember today?
The museum has 35,000 artifacts, and many of them profound, including Rosa Parks' dress and Harriet Tubman's shawl. There's also a segregated rail car. There is the Bible of Nat Turner. So there's so many symbols of the struggle of African-American people, and there are also symbols of the resilience and the accomplishments and of African Americans, and you can see that in the culture exhibits. A couple of things stood out for me, and these are on the upper floors. On the lower floors, you see the exhibits about slavery, and then and as you go from slavery to freedom, to borrow from John Hope Franklin, when you get to the upper floors, you see the emergence of blacks and their culture, And on that floor, what stood out for me was something I've been hearing about for so long, and this would be Parliament Funkadelic's Mothership.
No kidding.
And if you think of Parliament Funkadelic housed forever in the sacred grounds of the Smithsonian, it's just wonderful. And that brought me so much joy and excitement. So from slavery to freedom, absolutely.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree, Gail. And just the thought that people were housing these things. You know, when I went to my family's home in Petersburg, out there, his mother's former home, the family members had items in boxes, in shoe boxes, no less. And that's when I said, these things belong in a museum.
And did you carry with you some of the thoughts of this past week, the shootings in Tulsa and Charlotte, and even the history over the last 2 years that have echoed incidents like that, as you went into the museum?
I did not. When I walked into the museum, my first thought was, they have a home. You know, their voices are heard. That was my first thought. And it was only as I emerged to the eras of today did I see and have thoughts of what's going on today. Because that's represented there as well.
I felt the same way. When I walked in that building, when I saw all those happy people, I put all my cares behind. Just wanted to enjoy that moment. Everything was wonderful about it. The music was fantastic. There was a violinist playing Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Negro National Anthem. She was very talented, and one didn't want to think of anything but that moment and the accomplishment of that moment. So all cares left behind.
Absolutely.
And when today's headlines seem to want to pull us back to the past and mistrust and fear of the past, that's also a part of now. It seems as though for both of you, this museum was a way of stepping forward into a future where the past is recognized, celebrated, and, you know, the secrets are gone in some way. And that feels like a real American kind of celebration. Gail?
Yes, we have to continue with the conversations. We have to face our history. We have to have more transparency. You mentioned the shootings, back to reality. We have to have transparency with those shootings and understand why they're happening. And as I said to a group of police chiefs yesterday, we have to look at the eyes of people who don't look like us and still see our brothers and sisters. So, yes, it feels American.
Gail Jessup White and Don Felder, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Gail Jessup White is the Community Engagement Officer at the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello. And Don Felder is the cousin to the late tennis player, African-American Althea Gibson.
Yahoo!
Yahoo. How about hoy, hoy, hoy? Struggling Yahoo's much-touted millions and millions of users lost little value yesterday when it was announced that at least 500 million accounts with the company had been compromised in a massive, quote, state-sponsored invasion that occurred 2 years ago. Vulnerable information included names, email addresses, telephone numbers and dates of birth, passwords and security questions and answers may also have been compromised. The breach, which is among the largest on record, occurred under the leadership of CEO Marissa Mayer. It's not known if some Chinese or Belarusian hacker is walking around with her ATM password. This whole thing puts a big question mark, though, over the acquisition of Yahoo by Verizon, which is currently in the works for $4.8 billion. Chris Calabrese is Vice President for Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology, and he joins me now. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yahoo took pains to say this was a state-sponsored hack. I mean, do they really know? Are they just trying to make themselves look better? I mean, can you tell from the hack if it was state-sponsored? So poor us, you know.
there are indications when it's a state-sponsored attack, they tend to be more sophisticated. But, yeah, the line does blur. I mean, the people who are the state sponsors to do the hacking may, you know, also be the same people who are freelance hackers as well. So it's not always a clear delineation between the state doing something and just a bunch of kids in their basement somewhere.
So is this a situation where if you have a Yahoo account and do commerce on Yahoo, you better change all your passwords? Or is it anyone who's ever even seen a screenshot of Yahoo needs to do that?
Well, I don't think we need to go the full screenshot route. But first of all, they've made very clear that it's not financial information. And they've also made clear that at least the vast majority of the passwords that were compromised were encrypted. So they're with a pretty good encryption key that's actually fairly hard to break. So there's some small minority of passwords that's probably less well encrypted. So either way, certainly is a baseline. If I was a Yahoo user, I would change my – actually, I am a Yahoo user, and I have already changed my password.
But how can they say it's not financial information if they got – the security questions and answers. I mean, you don't have security questions and answers to go on a, you know, My Little Pony site just to see, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's actually – that raises the more important point. I mean, they know which particular, you know, systems were breached and where the financial information was. But as you point out, security questions can often be the key to the kingdom, and it's not just for your Yahoo account, but it's for other accounts as well. And it's worth taking a look at your Yahoo account where you can actually see the security questions before you change your password and just say, oh, okay, maybe I won't use these. The reality I think that most folks need to kind of realize now, and this is just the latest example of many of these, is that we're just not in a secure digital world right now. And we may not be for the foreseeable future. It's more like when you're driving. You know you get on the road. You know that by and large you're going to be safe, but you have to drive cautiously and be aware. You know, being online at this point is the same way. You have to take steps like two-factor authentication, using a password manager, changing your passwords to just kind of take those safety measures because there's just not going to be absolute safety anymore.
and to extrapolate that advice to the boardroom of Verizon, you know, these days you can't even spend $4.8 billion to buy a company without getting hacked. Is there some sort of due diligence issue? I mean, should Marissa Mayer have been more candid about this? Maybe she was when this acquisition was under discussion.
Well, you know, we do know that Verizon has said they just learned about this in the last couple of days. So it's clear that you know, it wasn't disclosed to them earlier. It's not clear in terms of the timing whether she knew about the breach before the acquisition happened or if that discovery happened afterwards. But I'm quite certain that Verizon's going to take a close look at all the legal liability that may arise from this.
Does it mean that Verizon would have to take on a class action suit if something like that is filed, or can they shield themselves even as the acquisition takes place?
I think it would be hard. I mean, certainly when you buy a company, you're assuming its liabilities as well. So I don't think they'd be able to structure something in such a way that they would have no liability, especially since it's probably not entirely clear what the scope of the liability is right now. But certainly we've seen big acquisitions in the past. LinkedIn is a recent example where there was a breach and the merger still went through. So it's certainly not, you know, a deal breaker for companies.
Is there a cost of doing business element to this in the sense that anything as big as Yahoo is going to assume that it's been hacked on some level and that there are ways and mechanisms that Yahoo can come up with or Verizon can come up with that will periodically encourage people to change their passwords or change encryption keys, sure. You know, make this more of a moving target?
Well, there is a security issue. There's always going to be security threats. Verizon and then Yahoo have to do as much as they can, and they have to, you know, they have to recognize security as an arms race and keep doing it. Your ordinary consumer, as I said, you know, I would move to a two-factor authentication where you use your cell phone as part of your login process and some kind of password manager to manage your account so you have one strong password that keeps the rest of them secure. And then you're in better shape than most people.
Chris Calabrese is Vice President of Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Climate change is a planetary scale event, but it is also the case that all climate change is local.
Temperatures are rising year over year. Our drought cycles are longer than what they have been, and our snows aren't falling as frequently.
That's Santa Fe, New Mexico Mayor Javier Gonzalez, a Democrat who's been in office since 2014.
So in Santa Fe, a community that is in the Mountain West, rich with tradition and culture, is feeling the direct impacts of climate change. So what that means is that our forests are highly at risk for catastrophic wildland fires. So when that happens, that presents a direct threat to the people living in our community.
Mayors have a special role in confronting global warming. They do not have the luxury of talking about abstract national carbon targets for 20 years from now. They might say carbon change is knocking on the doors of City Hall today. Here's Elizabeth, New Jersey Mayor Chris Bolwage, also a Democrat and the mayor since 1992. Bolwage and Gonzalez are part of a delegation of city leaders in New York City for United Nations Climate Week to speak about their very tangible predicaments.
In the state of New Jersey, we've had some severe drought issues, not as severe as the West Coast, but clearly the lack of rain over the last 2 months is going to cause us problems heading into the winter months. July and part of August were the hottest months on record in our city. And when you're the mayor of an urban community, the lack of trees, the lack of ability to deal with these heat issues is part of climate change. Hurricane Sandy was an issue 4 years ago where lots of places got flooded. We have 75 different areas that overflow and raw sewage can seep into neighborhoods.
The manufacturing town of Elizabeth, New Jersey, on the Hudson River, is trying to capture its surplus water, while Santa Fe, New Mexico, is in a severe tinderbox drought, demanding drastic water conservation. Elizabeth fights its war with tanks, says Mayor Bolwage.
So what the city of Elizabeth is doing is we've created 1 million gallon tanks in certain neighborhoods in order to store water and release it over time so neighborhoods don't flood. It's part of green energy.
For Gonzalez in Santa Fe, one of the challenges is enforcing a sense that we're all in this together, the golf courses, the restaurants, and the neighborhood bodegas.
The data is conclusive that people that are living in poverty, if something is not done, will bear the disproportionate share on their shoulders of climate change. So in Santa Fe, we created the Verde Fund, and the Verde Fund is a fund that was specifically focused on not only mitigating the effects of climate change on people living in poverty, but working to help people out of poverty. So think of retrofit of homes or solar rooftop distributive generation on homes where lower income individuals live. That just means that there's more money. If we can get some of these programs in place, we know that the energy savings that will take place goes directly into their pockets. That's money that they can use to buy fresher food. It's money that they can use to provide some means for their kids. I think you'll see that in cities across the country. As we approach the issue of inequality and developing policy, it is about making sure that there are strong educational pathways that exist for our kids and that we have economies where wages grow, but that we're also putting into place resilience policy to assure that people who are living in poverty, who are working their way out of it, don't have to bear a disproportionate share of the costs of what climate change would mean to them.
That Verde Fund was approved by the Santa Fe City Council in May, linking poverty and climate change by allowing low-income residents to install rooftop solar panels, creating carbon-neutral affordable housing, as well as creating new jobs in green energy areas. Gonzalez says it's a pilot project he hopes to permanently fund. Cities can try out lots of approaches that become tools for communities everywhere.
In our cities across our country, there exist these laboratories of great innovation and democracy. 91% of the GDP of our country is produced by metro economies, by cities. Cities are where things happen. today, in addition to worrying about police and fire and making sure that we're properly staffed and that we have good parks and recreation opportunities, now we're thinking about climate change and what is the impact on our citizenry and how does that affect the overall quality of life.
A tranquil art and tourist destination like Santa Fe, New Mexico, fights for survival in the southwestern desert, and time is on the side of that desert.
I think Santa Fe, if we can meet our goals of being carbon neutral by 2040, will be a community that's worthy of future generations that they can feel proud of. If we don't act now, though, I fear that our community could suffer from catastrophic wildfires, or that if we don't address the issue of income inequality, it'll only become a community for the extremely wealthy. And that really isn't community when you think about it at the end of the day.
In this very full week for the United Nations and the New York metro area, Mayor Chris Bullwage was keen to remind us that another 21st century global problem, terrorism, is also a local matter. His town of Elizabeth turned out to be the home to the family of Ahmed Khan Rahami, who set off bombs in New York and New Jersey last weekend.
You know, in the city of Elizabeth, it's a very diverse community. And in dealing with all of the media and the questions that were asked over the last 48 hours, you know, how come you didn't know about this? Well, if people are traveling to Pakistan or Afghanistan in order to be radicalized, they're not advertising it on a website or calling up the city fathers to say, we're going to go and get trained in this area. Whatever training this guy had, he clearly didn't have an escape route planned because that was really poorly executed. The time his picture was released, local police were able to get him in about 4 hours. So the question becomes, in Elizabeth, we are a diverse community. We speak over 50 different languages. We all get along. Time to move on, understand our neighbors. In the days of social media, you're a pretty young guy. Nobody's going in backyards flipping hamburgers and talking to their neighbors anymore because everybody's on social media. People need to know their neighbors. People need to understand their neighbors. People need to know what's going on. If you see something, say something. And that's what happened in Elizabeth when those two homeless guys found the backpack. They saved an awful lot of lives.
The heads of state in New York City have been spending their time building consensus about problems expressed in graphs, in numbers, speeches, and resolutions. But if they want to see the tangible effects of terrorism or climate change, they need only roll down the windows of their bulletproof limos and look outside, or just strike up a friendly conversation with a mayor. They're happy to talk your ears off.
People run for mayor because they want to solve problems that they see happening in their communities. And today's mayor is very different from when my father was a mayor of Santa Fe in the late 60s.
Santa Fe, New Mexico Mayor Javier Gonzalez and Elizabeth, New Jersey Mayor Chris Bullwage spoke to Takeaway producer Oliver Lazarus.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom framed prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
A long time ago, friendly conversation out of the blue wasn't so unusual.
My mother used to say to me, she'd say, in this world, Elwood, you must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. Well, for years I was smart. I recommend pleasant. You may quote me.
But the kindly Jimmy Stewart from the movie Harvey might seem more like a creeper today.
Now Kate was playing in her yard when a man pulled up in a very nice car. He said,
hey, little girl, I've lost my dog. If you help me find him, I'll give you this doll.
We are smart. We know what to do. We're going to say no to you.
And so from messages like these received as kids, we all learned to remain silent in elevators, airplane departure lounges, silent but for the screaming of toddlers, eye contact on the sidewalk. Don't do that. Writer Keo Stark thinks this habitual silent treatment among strangers is a big mistake, and she means to open folks up to the potential lifelong friend sitting right next to you on the bus. When strangers meet, how people you don't know can transform you is her manifesto on the joys of saying more than just hello and have a nice day.
Most people learn not to talk to strangers, and I actually grew up in a family where pretty much everybody talked to strangers all the time, and I was certainly taught not to go anywhere with a stranger, but it was very much modeled for me that it was okay to talk to people, to say hi, how you doing, to get into street conversations. My father was a city planner and my mother was an emergency room nurse. So they talked to strangers for their jobs and were very accountable to them. And I think that gave the whole situation a slightly different cast.
There's a lot of have a nice day going on in America, or have a blessed day. Or
yeah.
Like that. How do you get beyond that sort of?
You know, what's funny is it's very different in different cultures, what's okay and what's not. And one of my favorite examples of that is that I've been told by a lot of Austrians that you would never ask someone what they do for a living, but you often the first thing you ask them is what their political affiliation is. Like, that's a good way to start a conversation, which in the U.S.
That shuts it right
could
down.
Could be horrible. Yeah. Yeah. So I think the thing is, you know, if you're in a situation where you're not in motion, you're not passing by each other, let's say you're sitting on a bench together or, you know, across from someone in a cafe, and you get the sense that it's okay to try to have a conversation, which you kind of get from body language and eye contact and what the other person is doing. But let's say, you know, something has opened up a tiny bit. For me, it's about asking an interesting question that has a real answer. If you say to somebody like, what have you been doing today? That gives them an opportunity to tell you something real and specific that you might actually be able to respond to.
The start is the hard part. But these days, I think talking to people who are strangers, particularly, you know, of different backgrounds, is a worthy kind of thing to do, especially now.
I absolutely think it is, too. And given the kind of climate we have at the worst end of hatred, but certainly of not understanding each other, of inadvertently insulting people, making them feel bad, making them feel diminished with the best intentions and not even being aware of it, the best thing you can do is try to actually get a sense of who somebody is who's different than
you. Take a risk.
Take a risk.
I mean, it is about taking a risk. And I'm amazed as a person with a disability just how shut down people are by, do you want to be called this or that? Or can I help you? Can I not? And I mean, I feel for them because I just – there's nothing coming from me.
Right.
But I think in this society, it's just like people are so worried about what they're going to say to someone who's not their race or a person with a disability or someone who has a scar on their face.
Yeah.
And my whole life I've thought to myself, you know, I can just tell you an interesting story. If you ask me about it, I'll tell you a story.
Right.
And it just seems like the solution is right there.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean you take a risk that you might insult someone, and – if you see that you have, you apologize. But I think, you know, what you want to do is treat everyone like you would treat someone who is like you, and make sure that you're not ignoring them because they're different than you and you don't know how to respond to them or how to interact with them.
We also discover that they are like you.
Exactly.
That they all are like you.
Exactly.
There's actually, there's nobody that's different from you.
Yes.
But I do think that at a time when there is a focus on racial suspicion and a sense of communities not trusting each other.
Yeah,
that this is an antidote. I mean, forget policy, forget presidential candidates.
Yeah,
this really seems like something that could help out.
Absolutely, and it's this thing of, you know, these tiny moments add up to something cumulatively that's really powerful. There are also there's something called the contact hypothesis, which. There are hundreds and hundreds of studies that were done by social psychologists in the field and also in labs. And it turns out that if you have a positive experience with somebody who's different than you, you like them and their whole category more. You're more open to them. You're more curious about them. So this is – it's not only anecdotal and how you and I feel about it. It's actually something that has been studied and documented.
You know what is going to kill all this though?
What?
Is the little earbuds, social media, and everybody staring at their phones.
Yeah, you know, people say that a lot. What I see is that cell phones have changed things in public space because people talk on their phone in public space, and so they're changing their sort of usage and dynamics. But since I started writing this book, I started paying attention on the subway and really looking around to see if everybody is on their phone or listening to music. And it's not even true. For me, I'm starting to wonder, like, why are we invested in this idea that technology is making us tune each other out? And I actually don't have an answer for that. Maybe you do.
Well, it's another book, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I think – forget the subway for a moment, mm-hmm. Because most people don't have the experience of the subway, which is a very specialized social experience. Does this work anywhere? Does this work in a doctor's office? Does this work anywhere else?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing about the subway and certain other spaces is they're transitional spaces, so you know that you're not going to be stuck in that interaction, whether it's positive or, awkward, for very long. But in general, like in a doctor's office, yes, that's a great opportunity. It's also important to have what you could call an interaction shield, like a magazine or something, or your phone, so that if it's awkward, you can turn back to it, or the other person can signal that they're not interested by turning back to it. So it's a little bit subtle. But yeah, anywhere that you're waiting around with people, anywhere that you're stuck in line, at the bank, at the grocery store, those are all places where you could do this.
Keo Stark, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Keo Stark is author of When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform You. It's in bookstores now.
Hi, I'm Laura Miller from Alameda, California. When I was 9 months pregnant with my daughter, I came around the corner in San Francisco's Union Square and literally ran into Robin Williams. He put his hands on my shoulders so we wouldn't collide, said excuse me, smiled, and we both continued on our separate ways. I sang the lyrics, "He Touched Me," for weeks afterwards.
That's one of your Talk to Strangers stories. Seattle, Washington. I was diagnosed with cancer, and I was sitting in a bar complaining about losing my hair when a woman with beautiful platinum blonde hair interrupted our conversation. She smiled at me and said, "Are you going through chemo?" She laughed and said, "I've been through it 3 times. The second time my hair came back in black and curly, I realized that if she could have that kind of an attitude, while cancer might suck, my life didn't have to." Tell us your story about your chance encounter with a stranger. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway and talk to some of those strangers this weekend, won't you? Subscribe to The Takeaway podcast on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.